a man lights his pipe. The match flares in his cupped hands, catches the tobacco, and he draws until the bowl glows. He is standing watch in the Bitterroot Mountains, 15 trail miles inside Idaho territory from Nez Perce Pass. It is October 11th, 1863, sometime around 10 o'clock at night. A creek runs nearby. A campfire burns low. 40 mules and a half dozen horses are bedded down on a hillside half a mile above the camp. And the man with the pipe, Lloyd Magruder, is satisfied. The summer's work is done. Roughly $30,000 in gold dust and $20,000 in coin are distributed across those animals. He has a wife named Caroline, three children, a mercantile store in Lewiston waiting for him. He has done everything right. Chris Lowry is on the same watch. He has been on the same watch all night. Under his coat, an axe. Magruder does not hear it come. By morning, five men will be dead. The mules will be driven off a cliff. The bodies will follow. And a hotel owner in Lewiston will begin a pursuit that stretches from Idaho wilderness to the San Francisco waterfront. One man chasing three killers across more than 1,000 miles on his own money, because no one else would. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. I'm Shane Waters, and this is Historical True Crime, Season 40, 250 Years of American History. 50 states, 50 crimes, two per episode, paired by what connects them. This week, Idaho and Alaska, separated by 47 years and 2,000 miles of coastline, connected by gold, and by what gold did to the men who wanted it badly enough to kill for it. In 1863, a merchant named Lloyd Magruder loaded a pack train with goods, crossed the Bitterroot Mountains, sold everything at profit in Virginia City, and turned for home, carrying a small fortune. The men he hired to help him carry it had other plans. Lloyd Magruder was born in 1825 into Maryland gentry. His family had deep roots, a Scottish ancestor who arrived as a prisoner of war in 1653. But Magruder was not a man who lived on inheritance. He served in the Mexican War, entered as a private, and came home a second lieutenant. That rank was earned. After the war, California. Magruder ran for office and won, elected to the California State Assembly in the late 1850s, representing Sacramento. He sat in the pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. That is a biological fact, and it complicates a simple portrait. He was a man of his time, and its contradictions. By July 1862, the gold rush in the Northern Territory had pulled him east. He arrived in Lewiston, Idaho Interior, the brand new territorial capital, still called Ragtown for its canvas tents. No permanent structures. Within a year, Magruder had built two lasting enterprises, a mercantile store and a pack train operation. He built permanent businesses in a city that barely existed yet. Hill Beachy, owner of the Luna House Hotel, considered Magruder a close personal friend. That kind of trust, formed between men in the rough commerce of a gold rush capital, was not lightly given. It was not easily broken. Remember that. The friendship will matter.
Idaho Territory was created on March 4, 1863. Lewiston was the capital. Sternwheelers brought 300 passengers at a time up from the Columbia River. The town had Idaho's first newspaper, the Golden Age, and road agent gangs operated through the region, an estimated 100 persons killed in robbery incidents in the fall of 1863 alone. On May the 26th, 1863, gold was discovered at Alder Gulch, in what was then still Idaho territory. Virginia City sprang up overnight. Magruder saw opportunity. He loaded approximately 40 mules with goods, crossed the Bitterroot Mountains on the ancient South Nez Perce Trail, and sold everything at profit in Virginia City. The return trip, roughly $30,000 in gold dust and $20,000 in coin. Before he left, he told Beachy the details. He also hired four men, David Howard, Chris Lowry, James Romaine, and William Page. Howard, Lowry, and Romaine had departed Lewiston a day behind Magruder's pack train. They caught up on the trail and joined under friendly pretenses. Page had known the three men for approximately 2 weeks. The night of October the 11th, 1863, camp on a side stream 15 trail miles inside Idaho, stock released to forage uphill. Magruder and Lowry sharing their sundowned midnight watch. Lowry struck with an axe concealed under his coat as Magruder lit his pipe. Then Howard and Romaine killed the four remaining companions, Charles Allen, William Phillips, Horace Chalmers, and Robert Chalmers, with axes and a gunshot. Five men dead in the mountain dark. The killers selected one mule for provisions, chose horses, drove the remaining animals off a cliff, tossed the bodies after them. They slipped back to Lewiston and boarded a stagecoach for Portland. They thought they were free. They were wrong.
Magruder failed to return to Lewiston on schedule. Beachy grew suspicious. Then Page broke. Contemporary accounts tell us that Page, struggling with what he had witnessed, confessed the full account of the murders to Beachy. Whether Page was a terrified bystander or a willing participant who negotiated his life for testimony remains contested. At least one of the condemned men later contradicted Page's coercion claim from the scaffold, but his account was specific. Beachy believed it. What Beachy did next is the center of this story. He did not wait for territorial authorities. He left the Luna House Hotel in someone else's care. He funded the pursuit himself. A hotel proprietor, not a lawman, financing a one-man manhunt because the formal system could not or would not move fast enough. Howard, Lowry, and Romaine had boarded a stagecoach to Portland, then an ocean steamer to San Francisco. Their plan was bold. Have the gold coins minted at the United States Mint, converting traceable gold into anonymous legal currency. Beachy telegraphed ahead from Portland for their arrest. Then he boarded the next southbound steamer himself. He located all three in San Francisco. They were detained before they reached the Mint. December 24th, 1863. Beachy returned all four suspects, including Page, to Lewiston. A lynch mob gathered at the landing. Beachy physically put himself between the prisoners and the crowd. He had chased these men across more than 1,000 miles. He had paid for every mile of it. And now he stood between them and a rope. He believed in legal process. January 5th, 1864. First term of District Court in Lewiston. Judge Samuel C. Parks presiding. Page testified for the prosecution. The chain of evidence was described as complete. Howard, Lowry, and Romaine convicted of murder in the first degree. Judge Parks sentenced all three to hang on March 4, 1864, the one-year anniversary of Idaho Territory's creation. The court had spoken, and before the hangings, the condemned men would address the crowd from the scaffold, and at least one of them would say something that complicates every version of the story that has survived. One of them looked at the crowd and directly contradicted Page's account. The claim that he had not been coerced, that he had watched the murders in terror, that he had no choice. Page himself had admitted receiving $5,000 in gold dust. He claimed $20,000 in gold coin had been buried along the road near Walla Walla. That spring, he led Beachy on a search for the buried coins. He couldn't find them. He died in August 1864. The coins were never recovered. More than 160 years later, the $20,000 remains missing. In 1992, archaeological investigation of the murder site produced artifacts that may corroborate the events. But the coins, if they ever existed, how Page described it, has never been confirmed found. The Idaho Territorial Legislature reimbursed Birchie $6,244 for his out-of-pocket expenses. A formal acknowledgement that one private citizen had served as the entire justice system for this crime. Hill Beachy died in San Francisco in 1875. He was 53. Magruder must have been confident that morning, in 1863, loading his mules for the Bitterroots. He had hired guards. He had planned the route. He had done everything a careful man would do. The thing he couldn't plan for was the men he trusted. The Magruder Corridor Road, 101 miles of primitive track to the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, still bears his name. The wilderness that swallowed him is, 160 years later, among the most remote in the lower 48 states. The mountains kept his secret for months. They have not returned all of it yet. In Idaho, gold turned hired men into killers. Five people died in the Bitterroot Mountains because $50,000 was sitting on the backs of packed mules in country where no one would hear the screaming. Gold fever. Not the fever of finding gold. The fever of wanting someone else's. The arithmetic of murder. What a man is carrying versus what it would take to stop him. In 1863, that arithmetic played out on a mountain trail. In 1910, it played out in a mine shaft. Forty-seven years later, 2,000 miles northwest, November 1910, Fairbanks, Alaska Territory. Fewer than 4 hours of usable light. A man named Billy Wimbush is working a claim on Gilmore Creek with his partner. They have been mining together for at least 2 years. The easy gold is gone. Pedro Creek has played out since 1909. What remains is shaft work, steam points thawing permafrost, winches hauling frozen pay dirt, two men splitting whatever the ground gives up. Wimbush has been here longer than most. He has friends in the district. He has dogs at camp. He has a history of standing up for himself in ways that earned him respect. His partner's name is John Cooper. And before the month is out, Billy Wimbush will disappear. Billy Wimbush was born around 1859. He came of age in the years after the Civil War. This week's episode is brought to you by Guess Again, the new psychological thriller by Charlie Dunley, best-selling author of 20 Years Later, The Girl Who Was Taken, and Those Empty Eyes. If you spend as much time thinking about cold cases as I do, this one is going to grab you. Guess Again opens 10 years after 16-year-old Callie Jones vanishes from a small Wisconsin lake town. No body, No answers. Just a community, still living inside the silence. Then on the 10th anniversary, a dying detective makes a confession that cracks the case wide open, pulling a former cop right back into the work he swore he'd left behind. I read it in two sittings. The pacing is patient. The setting is atmospheric. And the final stretch genuinely made me set the book down for a second. If you're into Riley Sager, Ashley Flowers, or Alex Finley, this one belongs at the top of your stack. Guess Again by Charlie Dunley. Out May 26th. Pick it up wherever you get your thrillers. A black man in America that had ended slavery in law while leaving most of its machinery untouched. What his life looked like before Alaska is largely unrecorded. What the record shows is this. He arrived in the interior before the first Fairbanks strike, in the years where the territory was still the outer edge of anything mapped. Here's what we do know about the kind of man he was. In 1906, on Cleary Creek, Wimbush and several other miners were working a claim owned by a man named D.H. Cascaden. Caden had taken on leases, who abandoned the lease. He used that as grounds to stop paying the miners. They worked for the departed leases, not for him. But Cascaden had never told the miners about the lease agreement. He continued taking 40% of gross output. Wimbush became the lead plaintiff. He took Cascaden to court. Judge James Wickersham ruled in the miners' favor. Cascaden was found liable for all wages owed. What that victory cost? A black man in Alaska Territory in 1906, standing in a courtroom against a white mine owner with legal counsel, is something the Fairbanks Daily Times reported on November 9, 1906, but did not measure. Wimbush was known among the miners of the district for what he had done and what it took to do it. Fairbanks in 1910 was a city past its peak. Felix Pedro's 1902 discovery on Pedro Creek had built the largest city in Alaska Territory. The best years ran from 1904 to 1909. By 1910, production had dropped roughly a third. By 1911, it would halve. Pedro himself died on July 22, 1910, the 8th anniversary of his discovery. The population was draining south and west, following new strikes to Ruby and Iditarod. Wimbush and John Cooper had been partners for at least 2 years by 1910, working claims on creeks in the post-peak Fairbanks district, looking for ground that hadn't been cleaned. Two men on the economic margins of a declining industry. The record is direct on a detail that shapes everything that followed. Cooper was also black. This is not a case of white-on-black violence. The crime that happened between these two men was personal. The injustice that followed, the system's response to a black man's disappearance, was structural. When Billy Wimbush vanished, the authorities did not look. November 10, 1910, Wimbush vanished from the camp he shared with Cooper, near Gilmore Creek. Cooper told people Wimbush had gone hunting. But Wimbush's dogs were still at camp. His blankets, his gear, in interior Alaska in November, fewer than 4 hours of daylight. Temperatures dropping below minus 20 degrees. A man does not walk away from camp without his dogs. Cooper's stories shifted. First hunting, then a trip north to Shandala. Each new version created new problems. Cooper did not leave the district. He stayed. 8 months passed. The authorities did nothing. Wimbush's friends decided to act on their own. The reasons territorial authorities did not investigate are not fully documented. Sources cite the possibility that Wimbush's race was a factor. Miners moved around, and a disappearance was initially ambiguous. But the circumstances were unusual enough to demand inquiry. A man missing without his dogs, blankets, or gear. A partner with contradictory stories. That inquiry never came. In August 1911, after 8 months of official silence, Wimbush's friends went to the claim themselves. They went to the mine shaft on Gilmore Creek. At the bottom, they found a blood-stained straight razor. Deputy Marshal Alan Cunningham arrived at the scene. He ordered the snow cleared near the shaft. In the wood pile above, he found an old fire site, charred human bones, remnants of burned clothing, buttons arranged in a 6-foot linear pattern consistent with a body. The following day, searchers found a second burn location, 1/4 mile away. More charred bones, human teeth, more clothing fragments. The prosecution would later argue that Cooper had returned to the site after Wimbush's friends began asking questions and attempted a second burning. The second sight was not evidence of planning. It was evidence of panic. Historian David Reamer, who reconstructed the case for the Anchorage Daily News in December 2024, framed what happened as 5 mistakes. 1. The murder itself. Eliminating a partner in a small, tight-knit mining community where everyone knew everyone. 2. Staying. Cooper remained in the Fairbanks district rather than disappearing into the territory or fleeing to the continental United States. 3. Lying badly. Shifting stories that contradicted each other and that people who knew Wimbush would never believe. 4. Killing someone who mattered to people. Wimbush was popular, respected, known for the Cascadian lawsuit. His friends were not going to let this go. 5. The disposal. Burning the remains near the mine shaft, then returning to burn them again, creating a second evidence trail instead of erasing the first. August 13th, 1911. A warrant was finally issued. Cooper turned himself in at Fairbanks. The trial did not come until September 1912. Multiple delays pushed it more than a year past the arrest. The prosecution's case was entirely circumstantial. No eyewitness. No confession. Physical evidence from the mine site. Cooper's contradictory statements. The dogs, the gear, witness testimony about Cooper's movements. Before the trial, the Fairbanks Daily News miner observed that the jury would have to contend with, quote, prejudice against the Negro race, Cooper being a Negro. A sentence that mapped racial bias as a feature of the legal terrain, not an aberration. Not a failure of one's personal character, a condition of the world Billy Wimbush had lived and died in. September 25th, 1912. Guilty. Murder in the first degree. 5.5 hours of deliberation. The sentence? Life imprisonment. Not death. Whether that reflected jury reluctance to execute a black man, or general reluctance on capital punishment, or something else entirely, the historical record does not resolve. Cooper would be committed to McNeil Island Penitentiary, near Tacoma. He would never leave. But the story does not end with his conviction. It ends with what happened and what did not happen to Billy Wimbush. On February 21st, 1920, John Cooper died in the penitentiary following a failed operation by prison doctors. He had been behind bars for 8 years. And Billy Wimbush, May 1914, nearly 4 years after his death, Wimbush received a formal burial at Clay Street Cemetery in Fairbanks. For years afterward, some people did not believe any black men were buried in that cemetery. His grave proves otherwise. Wimbush must have been exhausted by November 1910. Two men on a marginal claim, in a played-out rush, working shaft mines through permafrost and sub-Arctic darkness. Whatever happened between them at that camp happened in a world where the sun barely rose and the temperature killed without shelter. He couldn't have known, walking to that mine shaft on one of those short gray mornings, that this was his last day, that the man he worked beside had done the arithmetic. The system did not find Billy Wimbush. His friends did. The system did not investigate his disappearance for 8 months. His friends went to the mine shaft themselves. The conviction, when it came through circumstantial evidence, assembled by a community that refused to accept the official answer, which was no answer at all. David Reamer titled his account, "The Five Mistakes of a Murderer." The framing is accurate. But there was a sixth mistake, the system's, and it was corrected not by the system, but by the people Wimbush had spent years earning the trust of. Two men killed for gold. Lloyd McGruder in the Bitterroot Mountains of Idaho, 1863. Billy Wimbush on Gilmore Creek outside Fairbanks, Alaska, 1910. Separated by 47 years and the full width of a continent's wilderness. Connected by the calculation at the center of both crimes, that gold was worth more than a man. McGruder, a merchant, a veteran, a father of three who lit his pipe in the mountain dark and never finished the draw. Wimbush, a miner, a legal fighter, a man whose dogs waited at camp for months after he stopped coming back. Idaho gave the nation its first territorial hangings. Justice delivered on the one-year anniversary of the territory's creation. Alaska gave a convicted murderer life in prison instead of death. Justice that arrived only because working men went where the law would not. In both cases, the formal apparatus of justice was either absent or late. And what arrived in its place was something older, a friend who would not stop looking. In America's first century, gold reshaped the map. It created territories and states, built cities from tent camps, drew men across mountains and into frozen ground. It also created the conditions for murder, isolation, wealth, and motion. Systems too young or too indifferent to protect the people inside them. Hill Beachy pursued three killers to San Francisco on his own money. Billy Wimbush's friends dug through a mine shaft on their own time. This is one kind of American story. It is not the kind we usually celebrate, but it is the kind worth telling. I keep coming back to the friends. In Idaho, one man, Beachy, decided that his friend's murder was not going to go unanswered, even if he had to pay for it himself. In Alaska, a group of miners decided the same thing, 8 months after the system told them, through silence, that Billy Wimbush did not matter enough to look for. What would you do if the system said that about someone you knew? Until next time, good night, friend.